Welcome to this special program, utilizing the Morbidity and Mortality Conference model to explore and improve community-based cancer care. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The program features a roundtable discussion with a clinical investigator and two community oncologists, where we talked about how patients who had recently died from cancer were managed over the course of their treatment for metastatic disease. The program covers three tumor types: wild-type non-squamous lung cancer, colorectal cancer, and ovarian cancer. For the lung cancer program, I met with Dr. Heather Wakely from Stanford University School of Medicine, was joined by Dr. Estella Mary Rodriguez, a general oncologist from Miami, Florida, and Dr. Maria Picton from Greenville, North Carolina, where she also is in general medical oncology practice. To begin, Dr. Rodriguez talked about a 52-year-old woman from her practice.
This lady was a 52-year-old, very independent, professional woman. She was a paralegal who worked full-time. She presented with shortness of breath and dyspnea that progressed to the point that she went to an emergency room and was found to have bilateral lung nodules. She was a never smoker. So when we met her, our first hope, everyone in the team was hoping that she had a mutation that we could treat her with erlotinib or afatinib. And then the first challenge was, you know, getting the results of those mutation analysis. So she came in, had a very difficult time with her biopsy, because first we thought it was an infection, but then we realized it's cancer, and then we had to wait some time to get the tissue sent out. We found out that she was wild type. Her tissue was sent for Foundation Medicine, and they told us that she, you know, did not have an EGFR alkyl RUS mutation. She did have a very interesting ERBB2, which is kind of the HER2 pathway expression there. And we noted that, but opted for chemotherapy because she was very symptomatic. I mean, she was really requiring oxygen. She was young.
So Heather, a patient who's a non-smoker, she had a non-squamous, what was the histology?
She was adenoma.
Adenocarcinoma, metastatic, who's sick.
Mm-hmm.
Really leading into the question of appropriate upfront tissue testing nowadays for non-small cell lung cancer, what it was 8 days ago and what it is today. So how would you think through testing the tissue of a newly diagnosed patient with an adeno non-smoker who's sick?
Well, I think it's dependent on how quickly you can get test results back. I think it's always important to emphasize chemotherapy is never a wrong choice. You know, if you look at all of the trials of chemotherapy versus targeted drug X, Y, or Z, the chemotherapy always does relatively well. And if you compare it to outcomes of patients who don't have a driver mutation, you know, it's still better than that. So if you're not sure, chemotherapy is going to be the choice if they don't have a driver mutation more than 8 days ago. And if they do have a driver mutation, if you don't know the result, that it's going to take a couple weeks to get that result, starting with chemotherapy is not going to harm them. You know, we've not seen survival differences, overall survival differences for patients, you know, in most of the randomized trials of EGFR TKI versus chemo, ALK drug versus chemo. And so you're not harming the patient if you start them with chemo if you don't know. So if you don't know, start with chemo. But we do want to get EGFR, ALK, and ROS as fast as possible, ideally within a week.
And would you say the current algorithm is in a patient with non-squamous, regardless of smoking history, who has negative for EGFR, ALK, and ROS1, that they need multiplex testing, next-generation sequencing at some point?
Absolutely. I mean, we've identified patients with BRAF, with HER2 insertion mutations, with RET. And in those cases, it provides us another line of therapy, which can be dramatically effective. Again, it's not curing, but it can really change their outcome.
So just to tease out, though, a little bit in terms of, again, the sick patient, which is not necessarily typical, but at your place, how long would it take to get an EGFR and ALK?
So we have a rapid EGFR panel that comes back within a week that's PCR-based, and then we have FISH testing for ALK and ROS.
And could this patient have waited a week?
They could have waited a week.
And how long at your place does it take to get EGFR and ALK?
So if you're Medicare age, you will have to wait 14 days for the tissue to be
released. I've heard that. Is that really true?
And that's still happening.
Wow.
It has to do with billing and not patient care, which is very unfortunate. But this lady was young. But even with that, there's this like resistance to not send tissue until the patient gets discharged from the hospital. So we have to discharge the patient from the hospital, and then I have to make a phone call and say, you don't have to wait 14 days, and the tissue will be released. And then some local companies will do EGFR relatively within a week, and the PD-L1 you can have within 2 days. Mm-hmm. But the next generation sequencing, that takes longer. Mm-hmm. It can take us 2 weeks to get the results.
So you mentioned PD-L1, and of course, you know, we've just seen the data that came out at the ESMO meeting in Copenhagen looking at first-line therapy mm-hmm. with pembrolizumab. Can you kind of summarize what was presented there and what you think it means to clinical practice?
Sure. So it was a randomized phase 3 trial for patients who had, and it's important to mention, there are multiple different PD-L1 antibodies that are being used in conjunction with the different checkpoint inhibitors.
But they're all IHC tests?
They're all IHC tests. And there's variability, though there's been some analyses done showing that for most of them, there's actually fairly good concordance. But still, this was specifically with that clone, the 22C3 clone, looking for patients who had at least a 50% expression cut point. So it's a pretty high cut point, and it's ending up being about 30% of patients or so who would qualify. And so in that trial, then patients who were eligible, who hit that cut point, and I think they screened close to 2,000 patients to get the patients who went on the trial, they were randomized to either get pembrolizumab or to get platinum doublet chemotherapy. And what the study showed was a clear progression-free survival benefit of a few months, and then also an overall survival benefit, which was what was presented. Now, the overall survival benefit was sort of based on percentage alive, I think it was at 6 months. And so we don't know what does that mean long term, but the hazard ratio was quite good. It's about 0.6.
Also, the response rate was higher.
Yeah, and the response rate was higher also. And mm-hmm. so we had response, progression-free, and overall survival. Now, again, it wasn't a median overall survival. It was sort of this at 6 month time point, and both numbers were quite good, but it was still statistically significantly better. And so I think that does change practice, such that we are, I think, now obligated in any patient with a non-small cell lung cancer to test for PD-L1, and if they're positive, to think about offering them that. Now, the caveat, of course, is those drugs are not, you know, pembrolizumab's not without toxicity, nivolumab's not without toxicity. I think we're going to hear about a case later where the patient actually had a fatal outcome. And I think where I'm most cautious is in patients who have any sort of underlying autoimmune disease. So that's where I'm a little hesitant. I know that there's some variation in practice, but from my standpoint, we're now making sure those patients are getting their PD-L1 testing results back as quickly as we're getting EGFR and ALK and ROS. And that's going to help guide. There's going to be the PD-L1 high expressors, the mutation-positive patients, and they're probably not going to be overlapping for the most part, and then everybody else where chemo is still going to be the best choice to start.
But, you know, you brought up this fascinating issue, which I hadn't even thought about, which is the sick patient. Mm-hmm. Because normally you wouldn't think about immunotherapy in a sick patient. But what do we know about, so we know mm-hmm. the response rate's higher.
Yeah.
What do we know about time to response, checkpoint inhibitor versus chemo?
Probably not that different. I mean, there was this rumor that it would take longer before they would respond. I've definitely had patients who responded very quickly to checkpoint inhibitors, just as we've all had chemo patients where, you know, within a few days that they're responding to the chemo just because they feel better, or if they're having tumor fevers, those go away.
So in a patient like this, mm-hmm. if, you know, this was 2 years ago?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, almost 3 years ago.
So a patient like this, if you got back mm-hmm. you know, the PD-L1 assay was greater than 50%, would you have used pembrolizumab or chemotherapy?
Probably would have used pembrolizumab based on this data. If you'd asked me that 2 weeks ago, where we hadn't seen the information, and in the case that we talk about for my patient, you know, if you don't know that they have high PD-L1 expression and not in the first line setting, the response rates aren't really that different. And so I sometimes would use chemo if they'd had a prior good chemo response. But now with this data showing that the response rate was a little better and the other outcomes were better, I think it's reasonable. So I wouldn't exclude someone based on being too sick from getting a checkpoint inhibitor.
And what would you be thinking about if the patient had disease progression on the checkpoint inhibitor? Of course, a lot of patients will, either initially mm-hmm. or longer term. Would you then revert to what was your first line therapy?
Absolutely.
And what happened with this lady?
So this was 3 years ago. So she began standard carboplatin, pemetrexed, and bevacizumab. And her goals were to continue to work. And she needed to continue to work because one thing that we don't talk a lot about is that young people with lung cancer need to have insurance. Mm-hmm. So she needed to keep her job. And she had a job that she could do part-time. So she was able to do that actually until the end. So she began chemotherapy with the goal that it would be 4 cycles because that's all that she could take time for. And then after that, we started on a maintenance regimen, and she did really well.
She had an objective response?
She had an objective and symptomatic response mm-hmm. very fast. She was not on oxygen. She continued to do her job.
And, any tolerability issues at all?
She had a little bit of hypertension, which was easy to manage, and fatigue. But for the most part, she appreciated that she didn't lose her hair significantly and that she was able to continue the maintenance regimen and continue to work. So she did maintenance for more than a year.
So I'm kind of curious. There's been a lot of debate, Maria, over the recent years about the optimal upfront approach. This patient had one common approach with carbo, PEM, and BEV. Other people use carbo, PEM without BEV. Some people use carbo, paclitaxel. How have you approached that in your own practice?
I actually had a similar patient 2 years, a lady that was young, and I used the same approach, and she had an excellent response. Later on, we found that she had an ERBB2 mutation on next-generation testing.
And how about your practice? Again, outside a trial setting, I guess now it's either going to be post-checkpoint inhibitor or knowing that they're PD-L1 less mm-hmm. than 50%. How do you approach that decision?
So I still use a lot of first-line carboplatin and pemetrexed. I think, you know, we talk about hair loss as being, oh, it's a lesser toxicity. But for a lot of patients, it defines who they are and sort of the appearance that they're giving to the world and that idea of I'm sick or not sick. So it becomes more important in some ways than I think we give it credit a lot of the time. I mean, I think when patients are faced with lose your hair or have no treatment, they're going to go for the treatment and losing the hair. But if you have an option where you don't have to lose your hair up front, that's very appealing. The addition of bevacizumab, I will consider, especially in the younger patients. You know, we long ago did the subset analysis from the ECOG 4599, the initial carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab, and we divided it up by men versus women and ages. We used 60 as a cut point. And the women under 60, small numbers, but there was a hint that the bevacizumab really seemed quite beneficial for them versus for women who were older, it was less so. And I think it's probably a reflection they had more aggressive tumors, probably more mutation-driven. I mean, this was all done long ago before we knew to even look at those things. But I tend to be biased by that analysis, and I definitely think about giving bevacizumab to my younger patients who are women especially.
So you think you might have used Bev in a patient?
I would have. And I really like the PEM and Bev maintenance. Mm-hmm. I think that's been highly active.
Did you have to do any dose adjustment or rescheduling, or she sort of cruised through it?
No, she did really well. I mean, I think it was 4 cycles, which she had a goal that was mm-hmm. 4 cycles, you know, 12 weeks you could get your hands around. And then the maintenance, she was able to continue to work. Eventually, we adjusted for once a month mm-hmm. because she needed to work. And that worked well until she progressed.
And can you kind of fast forward in terms of what happened for the rest of her course?
So she traveled to 2 places to look at clinical trials. One of the clinical trials that we had with immunotherapy, and then she went to another facility outside. And then after all that discussion, you know, I guess because she had a law degree, she just had a lot of issues with the consent forms, had a lot of issues with the biopsies. Eventually, I told her, well, nivolumab is going to be soon in the market, so why don't we give you what is our standard second regimen? And we had ramucirumab approved at that point. So she received docetaxel ramucirumab second line, and then didn't really like losing her hair, really felt sick. It was very different than her, but she was also sicker. So it's always very hard to tell if it's the regimen that it's hard to tolerate or you're just sicker.
And what was going on with the cancer during
that
time?
So she had, most of her disease was lung involvement, so she had more cough, more respiratory issues.
So just a word about docetaxel and ramucirumab specifically, it's been a little controversial because the benefits are relatively mm-hmm. moderate, yet the toxicity, and documented here too, doesn't seem to add very much. I do hear, you know, a lot of times when it seems like when there's borderline situations, people think more about it in younger patients. Nesitumab is another example. This woman's out there trying to find out about trials. How do you make that decision about ramucirumab or not?
So I think it's going to be very much patient-driven. And, you know, yes, for younger patients, I think we're all willing to take a little bit more toxicity risk because we think that they're otherwise going to be able to handle it without getting into too much trouble. It is some benefit. I mean, that's been shown in randomized phase 3 trial. It's a lot of extra cost, and that's one of my cautions around it. I think that the benefit is real, not big, but something. But is it really, you know, that additional cost is something I really grapple with patients. If someone's been on bevacizumab and seem to have benefit from it, I'm more inclined to think about having ramucirumab. Getting at that question of, if someone's been on bevacizumab, how long should we continue it? You know, practice in colorectal cancer and ovarian is different than what we do in lung. There's a trial that we're still waiting for results to look at whether we should continue it longer. So that's why I'm more inclined towards it. Actually, with docetaxel, I tend to give a weekly regimen of it, even with ramucirumab, which is, I know, not on label, but going back 15, 20 years, we had randomized phase 3 trials looking at the 75 milligram per meter squared every 3-week docetaxel versus several different weekly regimens, which really, from my perspective, seemed fairly equivalent. And when you give it on a weekly schedule, they often don't lose their hair, they don't have the same neuropathy, well, the neuropathy's still there, but they don't have the neutropenia as much. And so it's just a better tolerated regimen.
And what happened with this lady?
She had chemotherapy with a lot of symptoms for about 2 cycles and then really didn't improve and didn't feel well. And by then, we had this discussion about doing another biopsy to find another target because she had those targets at the beginning, join a clinical trial, or now nivolumab was in the market. And then we had a discussion, maybe we don't need another tissue because we don't need to test.
Right.
But I did test her original biopsy and she had 0 expression. I don't know what that means 2 years after the fact. But at that point, she started nivolumab and really didn't improve. Like, she continued to have shortness of breath. We didn't know if it was pneumonitis. I told her, we really want to do this for at least 3 months to get a clear picture if you're going to respond. And we pushed, but she really didn't improve and progress in the brain. And then she progressed in the brain in the worst kind of way. She developed leptomeningeal disease, and that was really, you know, her personality changed. And actually, our relationship changed because she became more angry at everyone, her doctor, her family. So it was a very difficult thing at the end because she lost a lot of herself the way she progressed.
When you, at the end, after she died, and you kind of thought about the whole course, it sounds like the thing that happened in the end must have been very disturbing.
It was mixed feelings, because before she really started losing her cognitive function, she actually asked me if I wanted to inherit her dog. And I thought that was such a lovely gesture of, like, I was someone close to her. You know, I don't like dogs, but she was willing to give me her dog. So I felt like very satisfied because I felt like even in the midst of that, she saw me as someone who was so close to her that she would live something like it was her child for her. So that was very touched and tried to just have a lot of empathy and help her family, be available for her family because it was very difficult. I also had a lot of feelings about the next generation sequencing. I, you know, felt like we never really treated her with a afatinib, which could have been an option. Although, you know, she researched it and I researched it and it didn't seem to have been the solution for her problem, but I wonder if there was something else that we could have found.
So just to pick back up on that, I was going to ask you, Heather, the 2 things that were found in next generation sequencing, one, this HER2 alteration, and then CDKN2A. But what about HER2? Was that something that, you know, maybe something could be done with?
It's a good question. Was it an actual mutation or was it just amplification? Yeah. So with the mutations, and there's probably about 2% of adenocarcinoma that has a true mutation. It's an exon 20 insertion mutation. In that case, then afatinib can work quite well, not for a really long time for most people, but it has a pretty high response rate. And then adding trastuzumab to either docetaxel or vinorelbine or some of the other regimens, that can actually also provide benefit. And there's research being done even with T-DM1, where it's just like case reports of 1 or 2 responses, but nothing that we can really quote. But there's a nice case series from Europe that looked at the afatinib and the trastuzumab. And in my patients with HER2, I have used those with definite benefit for a period of time for them. There are new drugs being developed that are specific to exon 20 that are getting HER2, but also the EGFR HER1 with exon 20 where we have challenges. So there's hope there. But with the mutation, I do think of that as a true driver mutation. And I have a reasonably large number of those patients. It tends to be more younger women, a little bit more Asian as far as ethnicity, and that's my patient population, a large percentage. With the amplification, we don't know as much. We know that that can be a resistance mechanism. It can also be seen early on, as it was in your case. And there we don't know as much about the role of these drugs. There are people advocating maybe trastuzumab is helpful, maybe T-DM1, there was a trial looking at that for the amplification, but it's not really acted like a true driver. And so I think there's a lot we're still trying to understand. So in my patients who have just the amplification, I don't always go with those drugs. I think about it. It depends on how many other lines of treatment they've had and other circumstances, but I don't feel like I've missed something if they don't get it the way I do if they have a true mutation.
I mean, there are data actually in I was really surprised a year ago for the first time we saw this on HER2 amplification in colon cancer and responses to trastuzumab lapatinib. And that's why the investigators now are getting HER2, which I mean, I never even heard of.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But I guess that hasn't been looked at in lung cancer.
There's been a little bit of data. I mean, trastuzumab was actually looked at in lung cancer about 15 years ago. Corey Langer did a trial, but it wasn't really selected at all, and it was a rather negative study.
Speaking of Corey Langer, I did mean to ask you, when you talked about that first-line Pembro study that changed the world, there was another study right after that really got my attention. It was Pembro plus chemo. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that and what you think it means?
So there have been several phase one and two trials that have been looking at combining checkpoint inhibitors with chemotherapy. And so the pembrolizumab data was updated at ESMO. There's also been work with atezolizumab. And in all of those trials, especially the platinum pembro plus checkpoint inhibitor, the response rates have been like 70%, 60 to 70%, which has been quite striking. What we haven't seen as much of is what does that mean for overall survival? What does that mean for progression-free survival? And the data that's out there is still, you know, smaller numbers. So I don't know that it's truly practice-changing yet, but I'm really watching those trials with a lot of interest.
You know, it kind of almost makes me, I know you both do a lot of breast cancer, think a little bit about the issue of ER positivity, you know, if you think about it. And, you know, we don't usually combine hormone therapy and chemo for traditional reasons. Do you see any potential problems or interactions in combining a checkpoint inhibitor with chemo, sort of theoretically, not so much drug interaction, but, you know, like hormones and chemo, they say don't mix, sort of.
Theoretically, yes. And so there were a lot of people thinking it was ridiculous that they were doing those combinations. But then when the response rates come out looking better than standard first-line chemotherapy, I think it's hard to argue that there's any true antagonism. Again, we need longer-term follow-up and to ask those questions, you know, that are always asked. If you combine everything up front, how does that compare versus one and then sequentially the next one? So more to look at, but I think intriguing. I mean, we've been very enthusiastic about those.
You know, when you think about it, though, you think about all the questions that are out there about lung cancer. I mean, you just, 10, I could think of 10 trials. Mm-hmm. They should have had a forearm trial that was phase three with 5,000 patients. Some get checkpoints, some get both, sequencing, et cetera. And then you have, you know, less than 5% of these patients going into trials. So I guess the infrastructure is not out there yet, or maybe never will be.
It's difficult, and I think one of the challenges we're facing now with the checkpoint inhibitors, as opposed to asking lots of different questions, we're asking the same question over and over with different drugs, and that actually is frustrating because I don't feel like we're advancing as quickly as we do. I mean, you can point to the, well, Pembro versus chemo was positive and Nivo versus chemo was negative. Is that because the drugs are different or more likely because the cut point they used for selection was different? And how do we grapple with that? And then do we need five trials of chemo plus or minus checkpoint or PD-1 plus or minus CTLA-4, you know, those are all being done in like triplicate and quadruplicate by the different companies. And that's challenging because we're not necessarily moving the field forward. We're moving everybody's bottom line forward, depending on which trial is positive that month.
Maria, any sense about this issue of clinical trial opportunities out there for patients? You know, you hear about all these studies, but the reality is it's kind of hard to find and particularly an exciting trial for a patient to go on.
I usually send my patients to the close universities that I have, Duke and Chapel Hill, for consultation. I just want to know if there's something else available, and I do it pretty early in the process. Very few of them get offered clinical trials. I do not know if there's no trials available. I go to clinicaltrials.gov. I see that there are trials available before I send them there. But I don't know if they don't meet the eligibility criteria. I don't know if they have a preferential population that they offer those clinical trials instead of a patient that's coming from an hour away.
I find that we rerun a lot of trials for long, and I find that there's a lot of hurdles. Like, you have to be first-line metastatic lung cancer that's healthy enough to wait a month. Mm-hmm. A month for your tissue to go to Germany to be tested, a month for you to repeat and get your insurance to approve repeat testing that is within 30 days. And also patients have a lot of hesitation. They feel that if you can get similar drugs of a clinical trial, you know, they always ask me, what would you do? And I'm like, well, I think you have incurable cancer. A clinical trial sounds like a great option. Mm-hmm. But it's hard when the options are pretty much what I will give you regardless in a different way.
Yeah. I want to go on to the next case, but just one final question. I was just sort of pondering a little bit about this woman's resistance to going into hospice. It sounds like the idea of it really bothered her.
Yeah.
How often do you encounter that? How do people react when you bring up the issue of hospice?
So I don't mention the word hospice. I kind of talk about palliative care as a concept where, you know, it comes a time where you will be best served by supportive care and chemotherapy is going to harm you and you're tired and sick and coming here all the time is not helping you and we can help you at home. So I try to frame it like that because I find when I say hospice, everybody shuts down.
Any comment on your own experience? I'm kind of struck by the emotional reaction that the word hospice, is that what you're experiencing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually I do. And that first meeting say you have metastatic lung cancer and the goal of the treatment will be palliative. But how many patients hear, they don't hear? You never told me that. You never told me that. Sometimes for them, the word hospice means giving up.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about this? You know, Jennifer Temel, is, you know, in lung cancer at MGH, has looked at palliative care, mm-hmm. not hospice care, palliative care early at diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts about that work and sort of this issue of the psychological impact of hospice and palliative care?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think palliative care is focused on symptom management, on sort of hearing what's going on with the patient, focusing on pain, focusing on nausea, focusing kind of the general well-being. And as oncologists, we always feel like we're doing a really good job of that. And so it is important to be very mindful of that. And for patients, especially who are having a lot of symptoms, bringing in another team, as you know, palliative care focused team can be great. I mean, I have the luxury of having a really fabulous palliative care group that I can co-manage my patients with. And so we do that, especially for someone who is struggling at all.
But you kind of pushed it, or you sort of emphasized more the symptom management. And yet the people that I've talked to who were involved with that, a lot of these patients were not symptomatic in that trial. And of course, the trial is just, you know, whatever. But the idea being that they were able to provide benefit even to asymptomatic patients, which is kind of hard to get a fix on. You ask the people who were involved and they say, well, you know, maybe they dealt with their anxieties better, they helped them cope more. I wonder whether or not patients who get that kind of attention maybe have a greater drive. You know, if you help them cope, maybe they want to live longer. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's hard to tease out exactly. And I think it's about, again, helping patients live. And we've talked about that early on. It's sort of how do you help patients live the best they can? And dealing with symptoms is important. Dealing with anxiety is important. Not squashing hope is important. The idea of hospice, I get that same reaction usually. And so I do a very similar approach where almost never with the first visit, unless someone's really, really sick to begin with, but kind of waiting, you know, and saying, well, you know, we've got this option and this one. And, you know, at some point, we might get to a point where the risks of the treatment outweigh the benefits of the treatment. That's the way I usually phrase it. And that when that comes, we think more about hospice and symptom management. And so trying to bring it in a little bit before it's right there. And then referring back to that discussion, because people usually do block it out, as you said. In California, we have a new law now, which is the Death with Dignity Act. And so that's brought in a whole new level of discussion. This is where patients can ask for physician-assisted suicide.
Wow.
And so that's a new thing in California. I've only had it come up with a couple of my patients so far.
Is that the main emphasis of that act?
It is. It's about physician-assisted suicide.
Wow.
But it has its other name.
And how does that work?
It's actually very complicated. The patient has to physically come to clinic and specifically ask about it. They're given an information. It's almost like a consent that they have to sign with family to hear about it. They have to take that home. They have to read it. They have to sign that they've read it. They have to have other family members attest that they've read it. And then they have to come back and meet again. And after they've signed it and said, yes, this is still what I want to do, they have to have someone else sign it who would not be benefiting from their death in any way, not named in their will, nothing like that.
And when was this passed?
It's just been in effect in the last year. And so it's really, really complex. And then if they go all the way through with it, then they could get a prescription to get the pills.
What pills?
It's like 90 pills.
What is it?
I don't even remember.
but do they have to have a diagnosis? Or?
Oh, yeah, no. They can only do this if they have a terminal cancer diagnosis.
And then they get a prescription for a lethal
dosing, which they then have to take on their own physically. So they have to be well enough to be able to swallow 90 pills.
Wow.
Of their own accord.
Pills.
Yeah.
Have you gone through this with any patients?
We started the process with one patient, but then she actually declined very rapidly and didn't make it for her two-week visit. And I did have another patient who actually was a patient who lived in Oregon, who came to see me from Oregon, and she ended up with leptomeningeal disease, which is, I think, one of our biggest challenges in lung cancer. Mm-hmm. And she decided to proceed in Oregon, where it's a different system, and I don't know
it as well. The same thing, they end up taking pills.
And she did take her own life, and I talked with the family afterwards, and for her, kind of coming from where she was from the minute she was diagnosed, that was a reasonable decision from her perspective for her. But for most people, I think that's a really tough thing to decide.
I want to ask you two, but first, how do you feel about it?
Personally, I have reservations about it because what I do is I try to help people live. And sometimes it's a very short time. And so the idea that they would say it's too much to me is saying, well, you're not managing my symptoms well enough. At the same time, I understand from the perspective of the patient that idea of being in control. It's mostly about the control. I want to control when this happens. I don't want to suffer. I don't want my family to suffer. And when it's about the family suffering, then I push back a little bit more because that's them judging for someone else. But if it's for them judging for them, that makes sense.
So I'm curious, Maria, first of all, what your thoughts are about what Heather just said about the physician-assisted suicide, but also how the sort of concept of palliative care plays out where you are. Do you have palliative care specialists available to you that you utilize?
Well, I haven't had the opportunity of facing anybody asking me to take their lives. We do have a palliative care service available, but not as outpatient. You have to be in the hospital to be able to meet with this team. And I have been pushing to have them open an outpatient clinic because I would like to have my patients that have a lot of symptoms go visit them and have them participate in their care.
How does palliative care play out where you are, and any thoughts about what you just heard?
So the palliative care part is, you know, it's a work in progress. I feel that insurances haven't really owned the palliative care arena. So, for example, we have a palliative care service like that in the hospital where they get cover and they see patients. But if you're outpatient, then you have to kind of break it into a pain management. And if they don't take their insurance, they won't see them. So it gets very challenging. And I find that we do the palliative care. Like, mm-hmm. At some point, I don't have to refer them out to, because I will be doing most of it. But one thing that has been very positive with the whole national discussion about end of life is that the new residents and the new fellows are having these discussions in the hospital with patients. And sometimes it's a little bit out of place. Like, you know, you admit a patient and then someone call a palliative care counselor. And I'm like, what happened here? Because I'm the one who knows this patient. And, you know, but then I realized, you know, this is okay. You know, this is another part of the team. Someone who's seeing this case, maybe I'm too involved in this case. And someone is seeing this case and sees that this patient is not doing well and should have this discussion now. So I think it took me some time, but now I'm very open to those consults coming from other parts of the team. But most of them are happening in the inpatient setting.
Any comments about?
I don't want to comment. It's very upset. I mean, I'm just not ready for that time. Yeah.
So let's talk about another patient. Maria, you're a 77-year-old man.
Mm-hmm. He was a very particular patient, meant a lot to me to take care of him. I was seeing him for 3 years before his diagnosis of lung cancer because of erythrocytosis, because he was a heavy smoker. And I have a very hard time offering this patient phlebotomies, and that was the ongoing discussion. For 3 years, stop smoking, it'll get better. Until he ended up being diagnosed with an adenocarcinoma, and he had surgery for it. Around the time of the surgery, his complication when he stopped Plavix was to have an MI. So by the time he came to me to discuss adjuvant chemotherapy, he was not in any shape to be receiving this. And after going back and forth, we ended up just deciding to observe him, knowing that he had a high risk of recurrence. There was visceral pleural invasion and other couple of things.
He was a smoker?
He never quit.
He never quit?
He was a guitar player.
Huh.
And he used to play in a local bar, and he used to play for his church. He was very involved with the church.
How did those discussions, are you treating him, you're phlebotomizing, now he's got lung cancer?
I did not ever phlebotomize him.
Oh, you didn't?
I did not. I have a very hard time to do that in smokers.
How was that dynamic of him continuing to smoke and then getting lung cancer? How did that work out, and how did that feel to you?
Well, I have a very strong position regarding cigarette smoking, like we all have, being a lung cancer specialist. He was a very pleasant guy. I would say, you're my favorite smoker, but please stop smoking. And he never did. And I think he drank too. You know, that's the way he was.
So he didn't get adjuvant therapy, had his MI, and then what happened next?
He had a recurrence of his lung cancer, and around the time of recurrence, he had another MI when we stopped the Plavix to get a biopsy. But I started treating him. He did not do well after each treatment, each cycle. He would end up at the hospital.
He got carbapenem?
Carbapenem.
What was his home environment?
Initially, he was very independent. He would come by himself always for about 4 years. He came with nobody coming to the clinic. But once he started being on a wheelchair and his performance status declined, he had an older child that came with him. I did not develop a strong relationship with the family. He was one of those rare cases. A very good relationship with the patient, but not with the family.
And can you talk a little bit more then about what happened to him?
After 2 or 3 cycles of carbapenem, I decided to go on with maintenance. He did maintenance pemetrexed. I believe he did about 4 cycles and did not tolerate that well. His CT scans show progression.
When you say he didn't tolerate it well, what happened?
He ended up being hospitalized again, but he had other comorbidities. He had uncontrollable diabetes. He was a non-compliant patient. He had unstable angina.
Do you think he had problems from the chemo you were giving him?
I don't think it was so much the PEM as it was his other medical problems, COPD, exacerbations, you name it.
Then what happened?
I treated him with Nivo. He did not do well. He just did about 2 or 3 cycles and then ended up in the hospital again. I believe this was pneumonitis. You never know if it's lymphangitis spread from the tumor or an atypical pneumonia unless you do a biopsy. And from there, he went home on hospice.
And just a word about the issue of pneumonitis. Obviously, in lung cancer, it's much more complicated than all the other diseases where checkpoint inhibitors are utilized. Any comments about your approach to diagnosis and management of pneumonitis? How often have you seen it with checkpoint inhibitors?
I've seen it in a few patients, and it is a challenge because usually it's patients they've already had some sort of treatment in their lung or their cancer's in their lung or their risk of pneumonia, and so you don't know. The most recent case I had was an older patient who absolutely was not going to have chemotherapy. We didn't have PD-L1 expression. She didn't have the tissue for the testing, but flat refused to have chemo and had bad disease with her lungs and was starting to become pretty symptomatic from recurrent effusions. And so I decided to start her on a first-line checkpoint inhibitor. It's like the one time I've done it without having had the testing done. And she was hospitalized within 2 days with an absolutely horrible pneumonitis, responded okay to steroids, but then decided, well, that's it, I don't want any more treatment, and decided to just go on hospice. And she did respond to steroids. She did get better. And so I think that in most cases, if we think of it and we start high-dose steroids pretty quickly, you can reverse it for most cases, but not everybody. But it is a challenge because so many of our patients do have that lymphangitic type growth in the lungs to start with, or they've had prior radiation where you're not really sure what's going on in that section of lung, or they get something that seems like a pneumonia. And so we grapple with it. It's a hard one. And I tend to be pretty quick to give steroids to patients in that setting if you don't know, because it's something that's fixable if we catch it fast enough.
Any comments? It seems kind of interesting. I don't know how, I'm curious how often it happens that he had MIs twice when anticoagulation was stopped. Have you seen that before?
Well, I think the kind of patient you're describing, yes, I can imagine. I have a very strong picture of this guy in my mind. It's a different patient population than who I tend to treat the most, but I remember from days when I was more in a veterans hospital situation and some of my patients who will come from a little further where it's just a different demographics where they are heavily smoking at high risk of cardiovascular events where there are patients, that's why they are on their anticoagulation. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I was curious about this patient because, you know, again, in the survey, we asked people to make comments, and I was curious about the comment you made, which is, quote, his attitude and relationships to his disease progression and multiple comorbidities was very positive, very realistic, an example to follow. I found that interesting.
Because he was very positive, and no matter how many times he ended up at the hospital, he would say, hey, doc, when are you going to give me my chemo again? And I'm like, Well, every time I give you chemo, I send you to the hospital.
Was there an element of humor in your interaction with him?
Yes, a lot. A lot. We had a very good relationship. He just would not listen.
Any thoughts about humor in oncology, Estella Mary?
Well, you have to be careful because not everybody can get your humor. But I find that it's like any relationship, you know. I think that you need to make things lighter for patients and for families. And sometimes I find like just talking about something else, like, you know, what's happening, what were you doing? Like I had another patient who was a musician and we spent a lot of time talking about music and he would bring me videos. And I feel like if you, not only humor, but being interested in the person and not the cancer, I think is really critical.
Can you present your 78-year-old lady?
So this is naturally another light to never smoker who presented about a year ago with a cough and was found to have what appeared to be a locally advanced adenocarcinoma of the lung after it was biopsied. She actually was taken for surgery and then in the mediastinal analysis was found to have lymph node involvement. So when we staged her, we found disease in the lung and then something small in the periaortic region. So we decided to treat her with curative intent, and we gave her radiation.
What kind of condition was she in?
She was healthy. You know, she didn't have COPD. She was very much going into this with a minimal cough, and at 78 was independent, didn't have a lot of comorbidities, maybe a little bit of hypertension, but really pretty healthy, that she did the radiation very well. And when we finished the radiation about 2 months later, in our follow-up images, we saw that this periaortic region truly was an area of metastatic disease. And her daughters were very involved and had done a lot of research. They were not medical, but they really have gone out of, you know, in the internet, there's a lot of blogs. They really have gone out there and they wanted immunotherapy. And then I had a lot of hesitation about immunotherapy after radiation. A part of me, you know, we went back and forth in our team talking about maybe the fact that she had radiation recently is a good positive thing, but maybe we don't know if it's going to make it worse. So she started radiation relatively quick after the radiation was completed. And then within 3 cycles, developed profound dyspnea. We started her on steroids as an outpatient, and then they were tapered fast. And then she got worse.
What was seen on imaging in her lungs?
She had a kind of ground glass picture that was new, and really hypoxia that was new. So this was, we didn't know if it was radiation-induced, delayed radiation-induced, or if it was the immunotherapy that she had just begun. But she ended up in the hospital after the steroids were tapered fast. And then at that point, we knew this is pneumonitis, and you're going to be here on high-dose steroids. And she spent all of the holidays, and she stayed in the hospital for about 2.5 months.
Wow.
She was on high flow oxygen. We even like consulted people outside of our institution about using a drug for rheumatoid arthritis, other drugs to decrease the immune system.
And your thinking was that this was from the immunotherapy and not from the radiation therapy?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to tease out the two, but we felt it was so profound. It had to be more than our usual. When we see radiation-induced pneumonitis, is very localized in the port of radiation, and this was really more like a global process.
Yeah, that's an interesting question I don't remember hearing discussed, which is how long after, say, chemo radiation therapy can you safely give? Is there any interaction? Do we know anything about this? Have you heard about any cases like this?
So there are a few. I haven't heard about too many. That's one of the most striking. It came up a lot in the design for the adjuvant trials, looking at the adjuvant checkpoint inhibitors, of which there are, you know, 4 trials. Only one allows for patients who have had postoperative radiation therapy. The rest are all excluding patients who are getting radiation, and it's because of the fear of, well, if a pneumonitis develops, how do you tell if it's radiation pneumonitis or if it's the combination of the two or just the checkpoint inhibitor? And so that's been an issue. Now, at the same time, the trials done in the stage 3 patients adding checkpoint inhibitors, at least one of those trials has been completed and there are others ongoing, but we haven't really seen the results yet to any great extent.
That's fascinating. Just could you summarize, though, what the trials are in the adjuvant and locally advanced setting right now that are involving checkpoint inhibitors? Are they generally chemo followed by checkpoint inhibitors? What are the designs?
So that's the design of most of them. And so there is the cooperative group, the National Cooperative Group Network, NCTN. Their trial is the ALCHEMIST study, which is looking for EGFR and ALK as the first step. And if patients have EGFR or ALK, they get the appropriate TKI versus placebo. If they don't, then they are randomized to either get nivolumab or not.
But that's after chemo.
After chemo. But you don't have to. So it's mostly after chemo. You can also have had radiation. It's the most flexible of all of the trials.
So you don't have to have chemo at all or radiation? You can just take the Nevo?
Right.
So I just wanted, before we go into the other studies, because I'd seen, I think it's pretty recently they added the Nevo part, right?
Yeah, it's just opening, and so it's not really open widely
it's about
yet.
To
it's
open.
Not really, well, it's open, but only a few patients have been enrolled.
But, you know, when I saw that, I was thinking to myself, I want to get on that trial.
Yeah.
You
it's
know,
a good
because
study.
I guess it's not that, what are the other adjuvant checkpoint trials out there?
So there's an adjuvant trial with pembrolizumab. There's one with...
It's just like what you just described,
there's one
pretty
with
much.
Well, those are different. So there's one with pembrolizumab, one with atezolizumab, and one with durvalumab. And those all require chemotherapy. They are excluding patients with EGFR and ALK if it's known. And they don't allow for radiation. But otherwise, they're very similar. So getting back to that idea of doing everything in triplicate.
But also with regard to the radiation and the chemo, I've heard, and I don't know whether it's theoretical or their clinical research data, the thinking that maybe they would potentiate, you know, stimulate PD-L1 production, potentiate immunotherapy. Is that the case?
Right. And so there are other trials being done more in the metastatic setting. We're opening one. There are a lot of others being done where you sort of do radiation and then do your checkpoint inhibitor right after. Or if someone's kind of starting to progress on a checkpoint inhibitor, you radiate the progressing site and then keep going to try to re-stimulate that response.
And the locally advanced studies, what is just chemo radiation followed by checkpoint or not? So getting back to the Alchemist study, one of the themes that came out in the survey is the lack of use of clinical trials. I don't know how easy or difficult it is. I'd be curious, Maria, in your setting, to access a trial like Alchemist. Are you able to put patients on it? But to me, if I put myself in that situation, I've had an adenocarcinoma removed. Well, if I've got ALK or EGFR, I either want those drugs or want to be on a trial of them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
But if I'm in the 90% who doesn't, that Nevo sounds pretty good to me. So kind of, it almost seems better than standard of care to go in the trial.
A lot of people don't want adjuvant chemo, so if there's an option not to get adjuvant chemo that is immunotherapy, I think there will be a lot of takers. We have the Alchemist trial.
How do people respond to it?
You know, I guess... I find that these discussions are best started with the surgeon because the surgeons have a lot of power in early stage disease. And if they tell the patient, which I've seen some patients that have been referred to me where the surgeon did the consenting for the Alchemist trial. And that was very powerful because it was already like, you know, part of your surgery is getting this tissue and we have this plan after the surgery. But overall, it's well received. You know, it's easy to get tissue, unlike the metastatic setting. And we get results, but we don't, you know, for the EGFR, our question, we'll have to wait a long time for the answer. And
so getting back to your patient, this is obviously a terrible situation. What was it like to take care of her? What was the family's reaction to what was going on?
So there was a question that was part of the survey, like, did you speak to the family or someone in the family after the patient died? And in all of the cases I did, I had a conversation or sent a letter. And in this case, the family was very upset. And I tried to make this phone call, and they wouldn't take this phone call, which is, you know, I was very hurt by it. But I kind of felt that it was just, they had so much hope going into this. I think they felt also very guilty that they pushed the immunotherapy on their mother, who was 78. And they just felt that, I think they felt guilty, and they were still in the anger phase for a long time. But when she was doing the radiation, she was doing great and was very gracious and a great patient. When she was not doing well, I felt that, when we got to the point that we were not improving her respiratory status, I wanted her to be DNI, and the family really wanted to keep trying. And it was very hard for me to see lung cancer patients who are dying being intubated. That's one of the more difficult things that it's just hard to round on those patients because you feel like you're just making things worse. So that was very difficult.
Is that what happened?
Yeah, she was intubated then died intubated.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's tough.
Yeah. Difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I kind of imagine, I mean, I know no field in medicine is easy. It's difficult to be a doctor. There's just something different, I think, Maria, about being in medical oncology.
Oh, yes.
What do you say when, I don't know if you run into residents or fellows who ask you, you know, sort of how do you get through it? How do you deal with it? What, you know?
Yeah, I have still a lot of interaction with the program I came from, the internal medicine program and the oncology program. And I get asked that question, what made you choose oncology? It's so sad. And I tell them, you know, the patients that you see in the hospital, those are the sick ones. We have a lot of positive patients that do well in the outpatient setting that never set foot in the hospital. You don't see that part of the patients. And yes, yeah, I think an oncologist needs to have some way of draining all these emotions that we face every day. I tell them, you need to keep your familiar life. You need to have a sport if that's what brings you. If I don't exercise, I cannot deal with my day, period. I need to have my 5 a.m. exercising.
That's where I was this morning. So, Heather, I just want to take a step back and ask for your global perspective on the issue of providing care to patients with advanced disease when cure is not feasible.
When I was a medical student, one of the reasons that I was drawn to oncology was that sort of a sense of purpose that people living with cancer and the people caring for them develop. And it was this ability to sort of stop and pause and think and really live, even as it's in the process of dying. And that's something that's continued to really be an amazing part of being an oncologist, because you're let into someone's life at that time when they really are struggling. And I think that one of our most important jobs that we play as oncologists is really helping people to find that, to really step back and say, you know, you really have to live for the time that you're living, because it does have a more finite point to it than you might have thought otherwise. And I think too much of current life is just rush, 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 and then you look back and what happened. So that was a really well written. This year has been a lot of reflection for me on that. One of my patients wrote a best-selling book, When Breath Becomes Air. That was Dr. Paul Kalanithi. And so that has really brought a lot of these discussions forward into the more general public. And I felt that with his voice of describing his journey, and unfortunately he lost his life to lung cancer, but he was able to really explore a lot of these questions about what does it mean to have cancer at a young age? What does it mean to be sort of facing death when you're just starting life? Because he was just finishing his training as a neurosurgeon. And he did a really amazing job of capturing our interactions as well. And I think gave people an insight into what it means to be an oncologist and have those patient interactions. So that's been a really challenging part of this year, because it's made me reflect back on it, but also really amazing to see the response that his book has resonated with so many people. And his widow, Lucy's done a lot of book tours and really been able to express that and have those sorts of discussions. And it's a part of our medical education that doesn't always get emphasized enough. So I was really fascinated by that aspect of this project, having people really reflect back on it. It's also one of the things I try to emphasize when I'm teaching. I just came off of 2 weeks being the hospital attending, so working with the residents who are getting younger all the time, but really kind of helping them as they grappled with young people dying with cancer and trying to help them see the, well, yes, this is a terrible thing that's happening to this person, and you need to be able to give and help them sort of see how they're still living. But then you also need to figure out ways not to have that come home with you and not to have that pull everything out of you. And you need to kind of, it's different for each person, but how do you find ways to regenerate your own energy so that you can continue to be giving in that way? And how do you learn from our patients how to live more yourself? So, I mean, there's a lot in that.
You know, and the other thing we asked about was emotional attachment to that particular patient. And we saw a lot of the docs were either very attached or somewhat attached.
I think it's the bond and how you build this relationship. And I also kind of find that the caregivers, like you are the person who they look to guide them through this process, because you have been there before. You had other patients who died and they're looking at you. They never done this before. So, you know, I find that you ask a question about have you gone to a funeral, and sometimes I've gone a few times, but I have gone because I'm more bond, have a bond with the caretaker, and I want to be there for them, because it is really that satisfying that it's not only the patient that you helped, but also that the family that you helped through this time.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's another thing that we asked too, Maria, in this survey, was what's the person's circle of loved ones? And one of the things we've been thinking a lot about the last few years are dependent children, either the children of the patient or the grandchildren. A lot of times, you know, the grandchildren are very, very close, maybe even being primary caretakers. And, you know, you kind of just wonder whether or not they get the attention that's necessary, whether there's a lot of trauma that people are experiencing. And I even wonder, our group's been interested in trying to see if we could develop education platforms or things that specifically address this. Anything that you've observed in caregivers, particularly minor kids?
Well, that first encounter with the patient, I think, is one of the most important ones. That's when you see the support of the family, mm-hmm. who's coming with him or with her to the clinic, and the attitude that the family has, disbelief, denial, anger. And you have to, that first encounter is critical. the bond that you develop with the patient and the caregiver, as you said it, it's really important to guide that process. You sort of look at them and you foresee what the process is going to be, because it's a decline and it's a dependency from chemotherapy treatment to treatment to come to the clinic. I think it makes it easier and you have a more gratifying experience if you have bonded with the family and they go from that denial and that anger to accepting their disease and accepting that there'll be a decline and there'll be a demise.
You know, one of the things, again, that we kind of pick your brain about, like, not just today, but, you know, we want to enlist you as working with us in the future to try to help us figure out, you know, what we can do. And one of the things that I think we're bringing to the table that not too many bring, that maybe not that much focus on, is general oncology. You know, the way the field is organized, it's very much in tumor fields. And yet, the way it's being practiced is very different. I guess before we get into the cases, one other thing I was just going to ask is, the man who wrote the book, what was his name?
Paul Kalanithi.
And how long ago did you treat him? What was his clinical story? I guess he's gone public with the whole thing, obviously, right?
Right. So he died about a year and a half ago. So he was diagnosed about 3 years ago with EGFR mutation positive non-small cell lung cancer. And he was in his neurosurgical training, actually finishing up his last year.
How old was he?
He was early 30s and presented with back pain and started losing weight and eventually was diagnosed. And I learned about this from my colleague who's a neurosurgeon who I work with all the time, who was just, you know, completely stricken with this news. And so I went to meet him in the hospital right as his first diagnosis was made, and then continued to care for him over the year and a half that he had his cancer before it took his life.
And what did you learn from reading his book?
So he divides the book, I mean, he's an amazing writer. It's really a masterful work. But the first half is really discussing who he was before he became a physician and as he became a physician. And so it's divided into my time as a physician, my time as a patient. And so I didn't know all of the details of his life before. He talks about how he grew up and how he had always been sort of fascinated with death. And just the way he talks about it is really poignant. I knew most of what happened from the point of his diagnosis, and actually he really weaves our interactions. It's a huge part of the story. And so that was what was particularly challenging. I don't think most of us ever get to really see someone else's view of a discussion that we've had. And yet in reading this book, I did. And he captured, I think, a lot of our discussions. There were only very, very few points where I was like, I don't think I said it that way. But for the most part, he got what I was trying to tell him. And by capturing it in writing, I think captured a lot of the discussions that we are having with our patients all the time about how do you keep living? How do you focus on life? How do you get to these decision points? And really was able to put it down in a way where someone who's not dealing with the cancer journey can look at it and get insight into what we're doing in the closed door of a patient examination room.
So with the theme of mortality and morbidity, looking back on his case and having read his book so you know what was going on in his head, would you have done anything differently?
Well, you always look back and wonder. I mean, it's more the, could I have found something that would have worked better? I can't look back at any of the decisions we made and say, oh, well, I should have done this. I mean, I can look back now and say, if only it had been a little later and I had access to, you know, a different medication, you know, some of the newer things that are out. But I do that with a lot of patients. I think with every new medication and every new thing that comes out, I always look back and think about the patients I had like 5 years ago. I'm like, oh, I'm sure that would have worked for that person and given them a little bit more time.
What about, and we asked this in the survey too, because again, we didn't see too many people who had, you know, things they would have done differently medically, but we also asked, what about interacting with him as a patient, as a person? Would you have done anything differently having read his book?
One of the things he focuses on is, I mean, he was a doctor patient, and I think we've all probably had other people in the healthcare field or people who think that they have medical training, even if they don't, but the ones who really try to direct. He was phenomenal at not overstepping, but I also felt like I partnered with him in the decision-making in a way. I tried to partner with everybody, but I think it was only towards the end where I said, you know, I think you're spending too much time trying to make all of the decisions and thought processes and let me sort of take over that a little bit more. But he did a good job of describing that, and I think it's one of the things that I'm sure we all deal with is, you know, you want to help guide your patient. You want to give them the information. At the same time, you want it to be their decision. And where we struggle sometimes, I think, is when someone's making a poor choice. And I think one of the most striking examples I've had recently is a patient with ALK-positive lung cancer whose family members are absolutely adamant that she needs to get a checkpoint inhibitor as opposed to other ALK drugs.
Wow.
And I usually try to be very open-minded, but in that case, I really felt that having her get a checkpoint inhibitor before either chemo or another ALK drug was really harmful for her potentially because she was already quite symptomatic at that point. And I had to put a lot of energy into multiple discussions to the point of saying, this is wrong, which I would never try to do. I was trying very hard to kind of, even if they come in with things that make no sense, to sort of talk through, well, I hear you, but this is what I would recommend instead. And this one I was like, I'm not going to do that. So that was challenging.
Just one more question. Which is, as you again saw yourself through your patient's eyes in that book, was there anything that he talked about what you were doing that you thought was really valued by him, that was important, that you were doing right?
He very well understood the message I try to give to my patients of not giving up on hope, of the uncertainty of the future. One of my things that I react most strongly is when a patient comes in and says, well, the other doctor said I had 12 months. That really distresses me to hear that people would say things like that because it's quoting an average. No one knows what's in the future for any individual. And so I always try to talk about things in ranges, about, you know, there are patients who get this disease and they never leave the hospital. And then there, I've got patients. So yesterday I had one of my patients. She's been on gefitinib for 14 years.
Wow.
She's doing fine.
14 years.
14 years, yeah. And I have... There are others like that, right, where who have been living for 10-plus years, and she had brain metastases at the beginning.
Wow.
And so
that was pre the identification of EGFR mutations.
Right.
That was the empiric days.
Right, yeah. Right. And so these patients exist, and so when a new patient's diagnosed, I think it's important for them to hear, well, these are the possibilities, and as each step happens and we know what your tumor's doing, we can kind of narrow in that number a little bit. But you just never know, and you don't know what's about to be released as a new drug. I mean, or what's coming out in trials. So there's always that uncertainty, and so it's living in the hope of the uncertainty. At the same time, you're preparing for the potential not good things to have happen. And he really captured that quite well. The only part in the book where I'm not quite sure I said things the way he heard them was when he had failed one of his last lines of treatment. He recalled me saying something, well, you've definitely got time. You know, you've definitely got X amount of time, which is something I can't imagine I would ever say. But the way he framed it was very interesting because he then followed it with, I think oncologists have to always have hope too. I don't remember his exact phrasing. He said it better than that. But it was very interesting, his insight of saying, well, I think as oncologists, we have to live with that hope with our patients because they are our friends, as you had said. They become a very much a part of our lives.
This concludes the CD on lung cancer. For information on ovarian and colorectal cancer, please turn to the other two CDs on this program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for this special program, utilizing the Morbidity-Mortality Conference model to explore and improve community-based cancer care.